Welcome to A Guide to Art, Activism, and Culture. I'm your host, Zoe Elena Moldenhauer. This podcast is brought to you by the Aerogram Center for Arts and Culture, where we delve into social issues seen in museums and in art collections today. Today's topic, family, Mormonism, and whiteness. Joining me is New Mexico-based artist Nicholas B. Jacobson. Jacobson is eighth-generation Mormon whose work seeks to unsettle the Mormon assumptions of masculinity, white supremacy, and capitalism, i.e. the foundations of U.S. culture.
Thank you for joining me. Yeah. This is our first podcast, and we're excited that this is happening.
Yeah.
Can you just briefly introduce yourself?
Yeah. My name's Nicholas B. Jacobson. I was born and raised in Utah. I call the southwest corner of Utah, which is Washington County or St. George, Utah, my home. And that area is Nuu territory. And so that's where I was raised, is among the red sandstone cliffs and the Laccolithic Mountain on the Siwits Ing Band's traditional homelands. And currently I live in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where I attended the art and ecology program at UNM. And here I am on Tiwa territory. And I guess through this project, I've learned to do land acknowledgements that are more than just the mention of the name. And so I generally talk about how the fact that I have access to these places and how they've are literally part of my body in the fact that I drink Rio Grande water from my tap, that the only reason I have access to these places and these experiences is because of the history of genocide and imperial white supremacist violence of the U.S.
Your art talks about your upbringing in the Mormon church. What led you to break away from the church and talk about your experiences?
So every Mormon male is commanded by, I don't even remember if it's in scripture or if it's just like something the Mormon prophets have taught, but every Mormon male is required and commanded to go on a proselytizing mission when they are 18 or 19. And so at that point, that was when I started to question, because I wanted to be 100% sure in my beliefs before I went and told other people they should also believe these things. And before that, because of the sort of small city I grew up in Utah, pretty much everyone I knew was Mormon, like nearly every person. And so I just, there's nothing to question, because it's just what you did. It's what all my friends did. It's what my family did. It's what everyone I knew did. But in starting to like sort of question the unquestionable is when I started to think about, so Mormonism has their temples where you have to perform these rites and rituals in order to attain eternal salvation, or at least the highest degree of it. And knowing that there were many people in my congregation who I didn't think were very Christ-like, were a little like more self-righteous than Christ-like, were going to be able to attain this highest level of heaven, whereas like some of the people I'd been meeting by starting college were really Christ-like people, but weren't going to get this, you know, level of salvation just because they hadn't performed the right rituals or showed up to the right church building, which just felt wrong to me, given that I was also taught that God is an omnipotent and all-loving being. And so it kind of seemed like an omnipotent and all-loving being would more look inside someone's heart than at the sort of whether, you know, the paperwork of the rituals that they've completed. And
that's interesting.
I think, the crucial thing that made me start looking elsewhere for meaning and purpose and cosmology.
The way how you talk about your work and the way how you piece text with your work, it's interesting that you're talking about the contract part of Mormonism, of language in the Book of Mormon. Can you talk about that, going off of what you were saying before?
So I guess, and it's funny because as a teen and a child, I didn't actually read these scriptures. Mm-hmm. it was more of like a cultural belief, and like that I would, you know, you go to church and you go to Sunday school and you go to Tuesday school and seminary. And I think I cling to the words because they're a very concrete thing for making the arguments that I wanted to make. Mm-hmm. Whereas it's a lot harder to make arguments with like cultural references. So I use a lot of imagery also from Mormon culture that I grew up with, but I feel like not a lot of people have visual literacy as strong as they do verbal or textual literacy.
Mm-hmm.
Because, for example, there's so many of these images exist that aren't seen the way I would see them because of, one, the historical analysis that I've learned and developed, but also because we don't tend to look that deeply into things, which I feel like is why advertisement works, is we don't really actually look at how it's doing what it's doing, just what it's doing. So I stick to text because I feel like that's a very sort of democratic space that like is accessible to many people. Also because I think that's where a lot of those contradictions come in. Like I was talking about that, like you basically need this paper trail to get to a space that I feel like probably exists beyond language. And so I guess those contradictions in that Mormonism and Christianity as a whole, and you know, many of the major religions are dependent on a text. Whereas the spiritual traditions that I've started to lean more toward, which are Taoist and Buddhist, which though they have texts, I feel like the daily practice, at least in the traditions that I've studied and looked into, the daily practice is a lot more important than the language used to teach and like illustrate that daily practice.
Mm-hmm. Religion is very complicated subject matter, and I think making art about it is difficult. You know, it's, you're talking about yourself, your identity, and how those relationships then manifest outside of that. So was it studying art that led you to separate, or was it the separating that led to the art?
Because I'd never thought about that connection before. So I was not studying art at the time. I did draw and write poetry, but they weren't really connected. But I, in thinking about that leaving the religion started my art path, I think is true, which I'd never thought about before. But the center of my art practice is questioning the baseline ideologies of my upbringing, like kind of the things that we don't question that are like too sacred or too important to be questioned. Which then I, you know, currently I branch that out even into the dominant U.S. culture that I was also a part of, as well as just the general culture of being in, you know, the land west of the Rocky Mountains. And so I think it did start what I now do as art, which is just investigate and question the things that I never would have questioned before. And so I liked that question because I was like, I guess so. It didn't really start my visual art practice, but it started the research / conceptual / like cerebral side of my art.
Was reflection part of the research?
Yeah, that self-reflection and sort of the investigating and learning new ways of thinking and new ways of being. At first it was a necessity because there was this major part of my life that was the center of family life, of friend life, of community, of church and school, because you know nearly everyone is, so it was central. And once that started to, you know, sort of fall through, then I needed to find new ways of being. And that like for me, it became similarly the way I was just saying, mine evolved into being like an embodied practice of walking. Mm-hmm. Generally in the preserves that are set aside for the endangered desert tortoise that lives all around my hometown. So that walking practice became the way that I would think through all of these, you know, new ideas that I'd never tried on before, which is still how the majority of the research, as far as time goes, was spent in and around St. George and Washington County, doing just in place embodied experiences of like trying to practice place.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, were there any outside influences that helped you on your journey to question the religion itself?
Huh. Early on, I'm not sure where those influences would have come from. Maybe music, because I listen to a lot of music, and I know like sort of the poetry of lyrics heavily influenced me at that age and, you know, still does. I know for certain that when I was working on this project and sort of the last maybe 10 years of my life, when I started to learn more of the social justice sides of my work, were heavily influenced by others. Like my current partner, when we met, was kind of the first times I started to learn about intersectional feminism. And so they started to talk to me about their experiences, like something that really blew me away because of, you know, the privileges I carry being in the body I'm in, is that they never feel comfortable just walking around town because every time they do, they're harassed or possibly assaulted. And I was thinking about, because so much of my life, even at that time, like I didn't go out into, you know, outside of the city to do my walking. I just did it in the city because that Omaha, this was in Omaha, which was a bigger city than where I grew up. So it was harder to get like out of town. And that just blew me away because so much of my daily life and practice involves just being able to walk and being able to kind of get lost in the walk, which you can't do if you're being vigilant about your safety the whole time.
Right.
And so from there, then the sort of friends that I started to develop through kind of knowing Lara, that then I started to learn more about, you know, racial justice, and then moving to Albuquerque, the culture here and the history of indigenous resistance to colonialism and white supremacy is like so strong and so present that I know for sure that I wouldn't have started this project if I weren't here, or at least a place like this, because you don't, I mean, I imagine there are people here who do, but I feel like you don't really get to live here and not be aware of settler colonialism and its violences and its like ongoing impacts on Indigenous peoples. Like I did the Land Arts of the American West program, and one of our stops on it was in the northwest corner of New Mexico, where there is a whole lot of fracking going on the Navajo Nation. And so we did a tour through that, and through listening to the tour guide of this experience, his name's Daniel. So through listening to him and his colleagues talk about the generational responsibility that they feel for this land, like that they know that their parents literally told them, like, this is yours, and it's like yours in this really deep and profound way, and you need to take care of it and pass it on to like your children. And that's just something that was, you know, like in the way I was raised and in sort of what I see as like US white culture, you don't really have that tie to place because you're almost supposed to like grow up where you grow up and then move on and do something else. And so through the experiences that are this place and this land, I started to really look into what my relationship to my land is and sort of what are the underlying ideas and ideologies that create my concept of home and place and land.
So really a deconstruction, then would it be fair to say of adopting like holistic view of the land that you now live in and are working in New Mexico and with that in Utah?
Yeah, I think that's fair. Especially like, I mean, to tie it into the moment we're in right now is thinking about people who are really upset about their history being destroyed in, you know, thinking about Confederate monuments, or where I'm from, the town is nicknamed Dixie because the Mormon church wanted to start growing cotton just before the Civil War as a way of hopefully bringing economic stability to the area, and as well as being self-sufficient as when they saw the U.S. was potentially falling apart. And so former human traffickers and enslavers were sent there to start growing cotton because they have experience overseeing cotton plantations, and they brought the name Dixie with them. And so St. George now is, there's a lot of people that are really upset about people wanting that name to
Right, reparations.
Yeah, I guess that was just that, that I think I would say it makes sense to say that it's a holistic view because that's what I feel like I know, is I now know the whole truth of the history of where I'm from. And I have a more holistic relationship with the land because I am more viscerally aware of the fact that my flesh didn't evolve with this place, that the language I have didn't come from the land itself, that it, like, all of these things were imported, that, you know, the foods that grow in this place aren't the foods that my people's flesh evolved with.
Mm-hmm. What's the connection or the influences that you have with some of the tribes that you're working in your area? Have you connected with them, shown them any of your work, or had a dialogue in any way?
So I guess in a couple parts is as I've said, the relationships that I've developed here in Albuquerque through students that I went to school with, and like the kind of conversations that we have in crits and that they talk about in their own work, I was definitely influenced by them and by, you know, the way the U.S. is understood by more people in this area than I experienced it, especially growing up. But I don't know that I could say I was influenced even growing up by Nuwu culture, because honestly, they're literally and geophysically marginalized where I grew up. Like, their reservation is out on the edge of town. And as the Sivitsing woman that I've reached out to and have been in relationship with, like, she says is that when she'd go into town, people would ask her if she was Mexican.
Mm-hmm.
Because people are just, like, in St. George, they're fully unaware of where they are and whose land they're on, and the fact that the Nuwu people still live there. And I would have been the same. Like, I probably would have just thought they were Latinx and been fully unaware, because it's just not talked about, like, at school. The way I was taught about it is that they, you know, it's that classic thing where they were here and they are no longer.
Right.
Or it's, you know, relegated to this ancient history that also somehow is now European history, because we call, like, petroglyph sites, the BLM signs say, like, preserve your history.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it's not yours, but okay.
Right.
But I have reached out to Shenandoah Martineau Anderson, and I sent the publication Land of My Breath, People of My Flesh, to her, along with imagery from before the exhibition was put up or made public, and before the publication was made public. I sent everything to her and just asked for her to look it over and make sure that I was being respectful about the land, about the people, and that, you know, I was also being accurate to what her people's history is, because for the most part, I was focusing on myself and then my own people's history to make sure that I wasn't speaking for anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
But because that history intersects and overlaps with Nuwu history, then, you know, then those stories came in, and I wanted to make sure that they were aligned in a respectful way. And so in exchange for her doing that labor for me, I then offered to do digital design work for her for these different projects she's working on. And so we did that back and forth for a little while, and then COVID got more and more serious, and so she's become too busy, so we haven't worked together for a little while. But there are ongoing plans. She's working on a book that her dad started, basically translating petroglyphs.
Mm-hmm.
Using indigenous sign language and petroglyphs to read these signs, because a lot of people call them, like, rock art.
Mm-hmm.
But what she's working on, what her dad worked on, is showing that these were language, these were, like, instructions and directions and history and storytelling. So she's basically building, like, a dictionary of his notes, and so needs them all digitized.
Mm-hmm. You've identified certain texts in the Book of Mormon where you say that if you are an indigenous person, if you accept the Mormon faith, you then become white and pure. I'm curious about sort of, like, the education of Mormonism, but also kind of, like, the education that you're now kind of trying to undo in some way.
Yeah. So almost, well, really everything about indigeneity in Mormonism, I did not know until I started this work. Like, in my church group that was majority white, I would estimate, like, at least 90% white. They don't really talk about it, probably because would be a difficult thing to explain without the racism of it showing up.
Mm-hmm.
But when I started this work, there's a Dene person who I went to school with who's a Potter and an ex-Mormon. And in his upbringing in the church, it was a regular thing. Like it was talked about often and often in insulting ways because, so the Book of Mormon has an ideology and a race theory that indigenous peoples here are descendants of ancient Israelites who were white and emigrated with God's help to the Americas, which at that time they suggest was kind of an empty land because the flood of Noah cleaned this land and purified it. And then God separated it from a supercontinent. And so it was basically leaving it in hold for some special people who he could give it to later and they'd have their own land to be good white Christians in. But then some of these people rebelled and are cursed with, the quote is, a skin of blackness.
Mm.
And so there's this sort of abject position where they are a cursed people, but they're also descendants of God's chosen people who Mormons believe are hereditarily, like basically cousins with British people,
mm-hmm.
which is part of, I can't remember the name for that, 10 tribes of Israel, British Israeli theory. So he would get people telling him that like, oh, you're a chosen people and it's going to be so special when, you know, you're lifted up and you're purified and whitened again and like really insulting things. But yeah, that these things weren't taught to me growing up in church. Like I wasn't really even aware that the Book of Mormon was about the history of the Americas, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm.
And that stuff really stuck to me later. And maybe I wouldn't have thought anything of it because also as a child, I wouldn't have like thought that it's weird that white people decided to retell and remake up a history of the U.S. when there are, you know, hundreds and thousands of histories of what this land is already in existence. And they generally don't line up with the Book of Mormon. So that my unlearning of mythologies about the U.S. went hand in hand with doing this project because Mormonism is a very U.S. religion. It was made here. It's headquartered here. It's about their central text is supposedly a history of this land. And just like the U.S., it's founded in white supremacy, anti-blackness, and anti-indigeneity as its like, you know, core identities that it's shaped itself around.
Right. And it's also ingrained within your family. You identified as an identity, what religion then becomes because you're part of a community.
Well, and really explicitly because I've read in my Danish ancestors, in their histories and their sort of, you know, their journals and stuff, they talk about how, so when they joined the church in Denmark, one of my great, 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 whatever, how many greats grandfather, he shows up, he gets baptized in the middle of the night, like they're trying to hide it and be sneaky. And he shows up to the work next day and he has a pink slip. And they're like, look, if you leave the church, you can come back. But if you want to be Mormon, you can't work here. And so sort of through that kind of oppression and prejudice, all of my ancestors, when they moved to Utah, they became Mormons and they became, I wouldn't even say they would call themselves like U.S. Americans because at that point the church had a very tense relationship with the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
But they literally talk about how they gave up their culture of being Danish so that they could be Mormon. And so I really have hereditarily and ancestrally, I have no connection to my European ancestry because they intentionally erased it.
That's interesting. So now in your stage and after reflection and creating this work, have you found a community of artists or former members of the church where you now have an open dialogue that allows you to ask questions and have more reflection?
Yeah, this is an interesting question because through doing this work and a lot of the work, sort of the research I was, I don't know if publishing is the right word, but posting it on social media as I was doing the research. And through that, I've had several people reach out to me to thank me for what I was doing. And often they are ex-Mormons. Some of them are still Mormons and are trying to, you know, figure out how to reconcile the things that they're learning from, you know, from me, and hopefully that they continue to research on their own. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, they have been ex-Mormons that reach out. But I don't know that I've actually developed community with them, because as I like thought on this question, I was like, I don't think I'm interested in like building an ex-Mormon community, because I've been ex-Mormon for as long as I was Mormon now. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just kind of something that I'm just not, like, obviously I'm interested in this history, but I'm not so interested in sort of maintaining the connections to it through community. But the focus on settler coloniality and white supremacy and the history of the U.S. and its, you know, relationship to white supremacy has led to me developing community with others who are also engaged in anti-racist work and examining their own relationships to settler coloniality and whiteness. So I've joined an activist group called Surge, which is a national group that formed as a response to Black Lives Matter leaders, basically saying, like, white people, you need to organize your own people and you need to work in your own communities, because this issue doesn't get resolved until whiteness is, or, you know, not resolved, but this issue doesn't get addressed until white people are also addressing it in their own homes and their own communities. Mm-hmm. But I've definitely been seeing way more ex-Mormon art that is doing similar things of investigating their history and culture and the lasting parts of themselves and parts of their identity that came from that, and sort of wrestling with the complications of still carrying things that, you know, are foundationally you know, white supremacist and violent and patriarchal and sexist and all the great ists and isms.
Right. So the vindication of your work, that some people have reached out to you and thanked you for that, has there been any other response that you are getting a better reception of the Mormon community, and if there is any, about the work that you're doing?
I have had like 3 people engage with me online who I know are still Mormon, which is really exciting, because honestly, that was like continually through this work, I was like, ugh, I almost wish I was still Mormon, because I feel like my voice would carry farther if I were. But Mormons, because of their history and sort of who they are, and that they intentionally isolated themselves early on in their formation, if you're not in the church, the things you're saying kind of don't carry weight for them. Mm-hmm. So it has been exciting when I've seen contemporary Mormons engage with it. I did have like one of my old friends reach out to me, because the way he was seeing the work that I was doing was basically like, I hate Mormons and I hate Utah and I hate my ancestors. And I was like, no, absolutely not. And it's like kind of heartbreaking, because like that was something that throughout the project, I was like, I don't want anyone to be able to see this work and walk away going like, geez, those Mormons. Because to me, this is like, this is about whiteness. This is about the U.S. This is about all of us. And yes, I'm focusing in on my own experience of my ancestors becoming U.S. Americans and my ancestors contributing to Manifest Destiny and settler coloniality, but that's not, we're just an isolated example of it, not an isolation. Like, it, you know, that's part of a much bigger project than Mormonism. And also because like this project to me is founded in love, like that I love the place that I'm from. And that's a complicated thing for me now, because what does it mean to be in love with a place and to have found spiritual connection in a place where the only reason I'm there is because my ancestors contributed in massacres and genocides of indigenous peoples who have been tending the very land that I'm in love with for time immemorial. And so, and also that, you know, I have met a lot of indigenous people who, you know, are from Utah or in, you know, the Dene Reservation that's right by Utah, or the Navajo Nation. And so to me, as you know, it's about love for those people and doing the work that needs to be done. Mm-hmm. And so it was hard to hear that some people were seeing it as like a one-sided thing. Cause also I wanted to hold like respect, cause obviously like who I am also came from my ancestors, my positives and the things I need to unlearn and the things that gave me the ability to unlearn and to question that sort of strength and perseverance and like doing really difficult things because it's important to you and because it matters. And because it means something bigger than you, like that also came from them. And so to me, I wanted to be able to have a place that holds those complications and finally, or at least finally from my experience, tells that bigger story or the rest of the story. Also my mom, who when I started this project, I think thought that I was using this research to push a liberal agenda, which was like, I don't know. That was hard. It just took some long conversations where, you know, we talked about how I don't support the Democratic Party either because it's, you know, it's two hands of the same monster that creates these ongoing violences. And so through conversations, I think she started to see where I'm coming from and why this is so important to me and is starting to understand those things for herself, not just understands why they're important to me, but maybe why they're important overall. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of that one's sort of like, for me, the most exciting thing is that for the first time in 18 years, my mom and I have been able to talk about my beliefs, which we kind of did a, you know, don't ask, don't tell, because it always led to fights early on when I was leaving the church. So it finally opened that door and has changed the way my mom sees the world because she's, you know, like I was saying, they intentionally isolated themselves and they still are. Like St. George, I think, is still a 70 to 80% white community. So you can't understand things like what's happening with the Black Lives Matter movement because you have no experience with the issues that are being addressed by these movements.
Mm-hmm. I think also with the mainstream media, there has been such negative, but also dramatized and that people really don't have that much information. And so they fill in the blanks with this fictional narrative that then becomes very harmful. So it is sort of understandable to see that a community can say, you know, maybe what you're doing might kind of feed into that.
Oh, I just like to say that it was negative. Like what I was focusing on, like I recently had someone on the internet really mad at me because I was sharing the parts of history that he didn't want to hear. And he's like, you're evil. You focus on evil. And I was like, yeah, you're kind of right. Because this part of the story never gets told. I never heard it. I've never learned it. I'm still to this day learning things about the U.S. that were never taught to me I have a master's degree, so whatever years of school that is. And so that's, you know, like, that. I don't know, I guess to acknowledge that, like, I am focusing on negative things. That's true. Mm-hmm. And I understand how that's, like, painful to see. It's painful to go through. Like, it's not fun. But it's necessary work if we're going to be responsible for the realities that we've created collectively.
I've mentioned to youth before, but what's your youth perception like, if you have any, if you have a social media presence and that draws a youth-based crowd?
Yeah, I think, I mean, because as happens, you know, younger people are the ones to challenge the sort of baseline of their parents' generation. And so it's been received a lot better, especially because people who are my age that are following me on my social media accounts are the friends that I had when I still held transphobic beliefs and homophobic beliefs and still was unaware of the white supremacist beliefs that I carry. And so that they have a harder time receiving it because a lot of them never left St. George and just got to keep living their life and are still surrounded by sort of the good old boys and the old guard who still perpetuate and protect the mythologies that are harmful to so many people. But the, you know, younger people don't have that problem as much, as well as the younger people who follow me are friends that I've made since I've started my journey of unlearning and relearning. I guess kind of also just a different demographic ideologically that are younger and follow me. And so I've gotten kind of very little pushback from any of them. It would be more the people my own age and older.
Mm-hmm. So I guess that leads to one of our last questions. What are you working on now?
Currently, I am starting to dig deeper and research more on the history of anti-blackness in the Mormon Church as a, like, sort of, for example, in 1978, the Mormon Church first allowed black people access to eternal salvation and sort of spiritual power within the church, which they have a thing called priesthood, which is, you know, males after they're 12 and on receive different hierarchical levels of priesthood power. And it's what allows you to hold like a sort of authoritarian position within the church. It's what allows you to enter their temples and do these rites and rituals that guarantee you eternal salvation, or, I don't know, promise you, maybe guarantee is the wrong word. And black people up until 1978 had no access to these things. They couldn't get married in the temple. They would never have an eternal family. They wouldn't have access to becoming a god and starting your own planet and spirit children, which is part of Mormon cosmology. And in fact, the second president of the Mormon Church said that the only way that black people would get into heaven is as servants. So there's a very long history of anti-blackness that the church likes to quickly and nicely make go away now. So I've started that work to sort of round out that triad of U.S. ideology and Mormon ideology of anti-blackness, anti-indigeneity, and white supremacy. And also, because of the work I've been doing more recently online since the uprisings have started, I've noticed that a lot of my old friends, like the people I'm saying that are my age that I grew up with, seem to not have a very good understanding of whiteness and white supremacy. For example, it feels like when I talk about white supremacy, they think I'm saying that all of the people who do this are white supremacists, rather than understanding that every person who has been educated in the U.S. public education system or watches movies produced in the U.S. or TV or listens to the news, or, you know, like, if you live in the U.S., you have absorbed white supremacist ideologies. And so just that difference between carrying white supremacy and being an active white supremacist. So I'm starting a podcast directed at white people about whiteness, that all of the sort of people who will be featured on it are white or have white family or are invested in learning about whiteness. So it's kind of like an extension of that work of that white people need to actively be engaged in understanding and acknowledging and reckoning with white supremacy in themselves and their families and their own bodies. So I've just started those sort of two projects. As far as what this stuff will end up being, it's hard to say because everything's so much harder to say where we'll be in a month, in 5 years, in 10.
Yeah. Well, I do want to say that your exhibit is, it has a tender quality to it, which is interesting that you do see like the delicate of whiteness, but also kind of how it's sort of slowly being uncovered and you begin digging through and you slowly start to realize like this heavy, you know, dark crater that it is created. And
yeah,
I think it's very powerful. And I'm incredibly grateful that you were willing to partner with us and to feature your work on our site. So we thank you for that.
Thank you. I'm really glad that it got to keep living because, yeah, my exhibition opened the weekend that toilet paper was disappearing from shelves. And so, like, we're eating food that was made in my kitchen that we were able to just go to the grocery store and buy without waiting in line. And, you know, everyone's joking about toilet paper saving you from a virus. And then, like, 4 days later, New Mexico had a shutdown order. So it was, like, right there on that precipice. So I'm really grateful that it was able to, like, keep living in this time where things are uncertain and it's, you know, it really can't live in a gallery anymore and be public at the same time. Mm-hmm. So I'm really grateful that you all picked it up because I guess it feels like a really important thing to be part of the conversations in this moment, because like something else that I think's been really important about it and like speaks to this moment is the overlap of, which is comes from the Mormon scriptures, where they conflate purity and whiteness together. And the way we talk about, so if white is pure and purity is cleanliness and cleanliness is next to godliness, then we start to build this idea that you're seeing really publicly in like the reopen rallies, terrorist attacks, that you're seeing how much Jesus is brought up in these things, that Jesus is going to protect them. And to me, this is a playing out of the white Christian American identity that has protected these people for all of their history. And they are now believing that it's going to protect them from a virus that, you know, doesn't care. And that the fact that these reopen rallies, the early ones started right after it started coming out, that COVID-19 is disproportionately impacting Indigenous and Black communities. And then suddenly all of these white people are showing up with, you know, armed and with their signs, like demanding to get back to work because they now believe it's not going to harm them because of who they are. And in a way it's kind, you know, it's not absolutely true, but like the healthcare system is built to protect you and not so much to protect Indigenous and Black bodies. So yeah, thinking through that like I was there doing this performance where I was purifying a Book of Mormon by making it pure white with a can of paint that was, the color is called ultra pure white. And so I'm sitting there in my white coveralls wearing an N95 mask, and I've got my, you know, Mr. Clean gloves that the brand name of them is Bliss. And so just like that, like I was doing these things and using bleach spray to purify my artificial white roses, because that's another metaphor that Indigenous people will blossom as the rose when they receive Mormonism as their own history and spirituality. And so just these layers of whiteness and antibacterial and the microbial genocide of those cleaning products, where they kill 99.9%, and then tying that to Manifest Destiny teaching that, you know, within 100 years of Columbus's arrival, 90% of the population of this land was killed through viral pandemics and physical violence, settler colonial violence. And so the land was, they literally say that it was cleaned and cleared and purified for the white Christian European immigrant to come and, you know, make the land a chosen place for democracy and freedom of their religion. And then tying that back even further, that the Mormon Church believes that this land was purified and cleaned via the flood of Noah, which was, again, a genocide of 99.9%. And so just tying these ideologies that I'm not suggesting that it's white supremacist to use hand sanitizer, but just the way that we've developed a culture that performs erasure, like complete obliteration, rather than taking a nuanced and sort of more of a caretaking approach, we purify with bleach instead. And so just seeing that sort of messy amoeba of ideologies being made really clear in the reopen rallies, in the police brutality, that's, people are protesting police brutality and the police are meeting it with more police brutality. And yeah, so just this way that violence is taught through Christianity, that, you know, to me, it's like, it's no wonder that we're such a warmongering nation when one of the foundational beliefs we have is that when God wanted to deal with a problem, he just wiped them all out rather than, you know, transformative justice or something else instead. Being an omnipotent and all-powerful being, I feel like there were other ways you could have dealt with that problem. So that, yeah, I guess just that sort of weird mix of purity as something that means you don't have a disease, and it also means that you're white, and the way that we form massacres as cleaning rituals, mm-hmm. is just kind of this weird thing that I didn't. It's just strange seeing something that I thought about a lot suddenly become something that I never thought about.
You know, and I'm thinking now you have household imagery like Aunt Jemima, or I think it's the butter with the Native American.
Oh yeah, the Land of Lakes.
And how massive corporations are now doing a quick erasure of, you know, cover up a mistake that's been ingrained.
Yeah, without any actual change. There's no institutional structural change. They just took, I mean, it's helpful because, yeah, like these things mean something and they say something that most of us are unaware they're even being said by these images. So it's like, it's still important. But like I saw a joke online that the Land O'Lakes, you know, butter package especially, they took off the quote unquote Indian, but they kept the land.
Mm-hmm.
This story has occurred.
very on the nose on that one. I saw that.
Yeah. Oh, nice. Yeah.
Well, is there any reflections or thoughts that you have to wrap things up?
I guess just gratitude. Like, I'm really grateful to you and the center for, you know, allowing this work to keep living and to kind of grow and change and hopefully reach more people, that, you know, this conversation can keep growing. Also just to, you know, thank my partner, Laura, for all of the work that they've done that's helped me, you know, be able to do this kind of work. My friend Angela Drakeford has kind of been like a constant presence through this project and helping me think through these things, and also a person who constantly like kept me in check of reminding me the importance of kindness in this project, because, you know, I got angry several times throughout it. And when I'd start doing works that were coming out of that anger, I was recreating the violences that I was trying to address. I was making more of the thing. I was saying, we don't need more of this. Mm. So that, I, you know, a lot of gratitude for her patience and kindness. And for my mom in engaging in this work with me and like having really difficult conversations with me that are, you know, a direct challenge to her identity, because she is Mormon. And so I can't imagine these words, you know, it's not really something you want to go toward. And so I'm grateful for her for being with me through that. And Shenandoah Martineau Anderson, for one, that she has this 3-hour oral history interview, which is where the majority of the knowledge that I got about the specific relationship between Washington County and St. George City and the Tsimshian tribe came from her. And then for, you know, doing the labor of looking over this traumatizing story that's, you know, to me can be sort of disembodied more than I think it could be for her. You know, my people did the erasing, which carries its own form of visceral and embodied violence, but not really the same kind that comes from your people's history being erased. And then also I want to express gratitude to the land here in New Mexico, to the Tiwa territory, where, you know, like literally my body has been sustained to be able to do this work because of this land and because of the people who took care of it for, you know, millennia. And then lastly, grateful for Tsimshian land and the Nuu territory that I grew up in southwestern Utah, because it, you know, that place literally saved me. And knowing that the relationship that Indigenous peoples have to land and how that's the source of their cultures, that maybe I was able to glean some of that by being in that land, I guess, not to say to indigenize myself, but to express the agency that I see in the land, that it taught me things, like I learned things from that place. And so I'm grateful to that land and to the new people who tended it.
This has been A Guide to Art, Activism, and Culture, a podcast from the Iragrim Center for Arts and Culture. I have been your host, Zoe Elena Moldenhauer. Join us on our next episode, and in the meantime, visit our website at www.iragrim.org or follow us on social media at Iragrim Arts to learn about opportunities, events, and more for artists and artists.